May Crandall agrees blandly. But that's not so uncommon.
No, I suppose not.
She doesn't offer any more information. Reluctantly, I put the frame back on the nightstand. May watches my phone as it buzzes a second time, my mother's text message demanding acknowledgement. I know better than to leave it unanswered. It was lovely meeting you. I attempt to excuse myself.
Do you have to go?
I'm afraid I do, but I'll ask my grandmother if she recognizes your name. She moistens her lips, emits a small cluck as they part.
You'll come back, and I'll share the story of the photo then.
Pivoting with surprising agility and without using her cane, she starts toward the door, adding,
Perhaps.
She's gone before I can answer. I grab a better shot of the picture, then hurry off. In the lobby, Ian is scrolling through emails on his cell phone. Apparently, he gave up on waiting in the car.
Sorry that took so long, I say.
Oh, hey, no problem at all. It gave me the chance to sort my inbox.
The nursing home director walks by and frowns, probably wondering why I'm still here. If I weren't a Stafford, she'd undoubtedly stop and ask questions. As it is, she pointedly looks away and moves on. Even after 2 months back in South Carolina, it's still strange, getting the rock star treatment just because of my family name. In Maryland, I often knew people for months before they even realized my father was a senator. It was nice having the chance to prove myself as myself. Ian and I proceed to the car, and we're quickly bogged down in road construction traffic, so I use the time to call my mother. There will be no getting answers from her at home, with a DAR meeting being hosted there. After it's over, she'll be busy making sure every china plate and punch glass is back in its rightful place. That's Honeybee. She's an organizational whiz. She also never forgets a name.
Do we know a May Crandall? I ask after she has requested that I happen by the DAR gathering so as to make an appearance, shake hands, and score a few points with all the right wives.
Get the women and you've got the vote, my father always says. Only foolish men underestimate their power.
I don't think so, my mother muses. Crandall.
May Crandall. She's around Grandma Judy's age. Maybe they played bridge together?
Oh, goodness, no. The women Grandma Judy played bridge with are friends.
By friends, she means long-term acquaintances of the family with ties that are generations old for the most part. People of our social circle. Lois Hartstein, Doc Greeley, Minnie Clarkson. They're all people you already know.
Okay.
Perhaps May Crandall really is just an addled old woman with a head full of jumbled memories that bear only a partial resemblance to reality. That doesn't explain the photo on the nightstand, though.
Why?
No real reason. I met her today at the nursing home.
Well, how sweet. That was kind of you to chat with her. Those people get so very lonely. She probably just knows of us, Avery. Many people do.
I cringe and hope Ian can't hear my mother's end of the conversation. It's embarrassing. The question of the photograph still nibbles at the corner of my brain.
Who's going by to see Grandma Judy tonight?
I was planning to, after the DAR meeting, if it's not too late.
Mom sighs. Your father won't be able to.
Unfailingly, Honeybee holds down the family responsibilities when Dad's job prevents him from doing so.
Why don't you stay home and rest after the meeting? I suggest.
I'll go.
But you're coming by the meeting first, Mom presses.
Bitsy is back from her trip to Lake Tahoe. She's dying to see you.
Suddenly, I have the horrible, desperate feeling a wild animal must experience when the door swings shut on a cage. No wonder my mother wants me to come by her D.A.R. get-together. Bitsy is back in town. Given the party attendees, I can count on a multi-pronged interrogation about whether Elliot and I have set a wedding date, selected china and silver patterns, talked about a venue and season, indoor, outdoor, winter, spring. We're not in any rush. We're both really busy right now. We're just waiting to see what feels right, isn't what Bitsy wants to hear. Once she and the D.A.R. ladies have me cornered, they won't let me go until they've used every tool in their arsenal to get the answers thereafter. I have a sinking feeling I might not be making it by Magnolia Manor this evening to ask Grandma Judy about the photo after all.
Chapter 6 Rill. In my dream, we're free on the river. The Model T engine Briny fixed to the back of the boat drives us up water easy. Like we haven't got any weight at all. Queenie sits up top of the cabin like she's riding an elephant. Her head's tossed back. Her hair flowing out from under her feathery red hat. She's singing a song she learned from an old Irishman in one of the shanty camps. "Ain't she pretty as a queen?" Briny asks. The sun is warm, and the song sparrows sing, and the fat bass jump out of the water. A flock of white pelicans flies over in a big old arrow shape pointing north, which means the whole summer still ahead of us. There's not a paddle wheeler, or a flatboat, or a tug, or a barge in sight anywhere. The river is ours. Only ours. "And what's that make you?" Briny asks me in my dream.
"Princess Rill of Kingdom Arcadia," I yell out.
Briny sets a honeysuckle flower crown on my head and pronounces it so, just like the kings in the storybooks. In the morning when I wake, there's a sweet taste still in my mouth. It lasts until I open my eyes and think about why we're all five in Queenie and Briny's bed, flopped across the mattress like a fisherman's catch, sweaty and slick. Queenie's not here. It barely gets through my head before I know what's pulled me from my dream. Somebody's knocking on the door. My heart jumps up, and I jump with it, tugging one of Queenie's shawls over my nightgown while I cross the shanty floor. It's Zed on the other side of the door, and even through the window glass, I can see that his white-whiskered face is long and sad. My gut turns into a slipknot. Outside, the storm's gone. It'll be a nice day. The morning air's turned warm and steamy. But I open the door and step outside, and feel cold right through the old cotton nightie Queenie sewed a ruffle to because I'd gotten so tall. Queenie said a girl my age hadn't ought to have her legs showing so much. I pull the shawl tighter over my chest, not because of Zed, or because I've got any woman parts to hide. Queenie says that'll happen when it's time, and it just ain't time yet. But because there's a boy in Zed's John boat. He's a skinny thing, but tall. He's got dark skin like a Cajun or an Indian. Not quite a man yet, I'd say, but older than me. Maybe 15 or so. Zed's always got somebody under his wing. He's the grandpappy of the whole river. The kid hides his face under a raggy newsboy cap, looking at the bottom of the boat, not at me. Zed skips the introducing. I know what that means, but I wish I didn't. Zed's hand feels heavy on my shoulder. It's meant for a comfort, but I want to run away from it. Scat off somewhere down the bank, my feet flying so fast they barely leave tracks in the washed-up sand. Tears shove up my throat, and I swallow hard. Fern's face presses against the window behind me. Figures she'd wake up and follow along. She never lets me get far.
"Queenie's babies didn't make it,"
Zeed's not one to chase around the bush with his words. Something dies inside me. A little brother or sister I was planning to hold like a new china doll. Not either one? The doc said no. Couldn't save neither of them. Said it wouldn't have made no matter if and Briny'd got your mama to the hospital sooner. The babies just wasn't meant for this world, that's all. I shake my head hard, trying to wick those words out of my ears, like water after a swim. That can't be true. Not in Kingdom Arcadia. The river is our magic. Briny always promised it'd take care of us. What'd Briny say? He's pretty broke up. I left him there with your mama. They had some hospital papers to sign and whatnot. They hadn't told her about the babies yet. Reckon Briny will when she's woke up good. She'll be all right, Doc said. But I know Queenie. She won't be all right. Nothing makes her happier than a brand new sweet baby to cuddle. Zeed tells me he figures he'd better go back to the hospital. Briny wasn't in a good way this morning. I was gonna see if and there wasn't a woman down in the river camp who'd come look after y'all youngins, but the pickin' was sparse. Been some trouble with the police, and most all the shanty folk done took to the river. I brung Silas to watch over you till I can get your daddy back home. He motions to the boy in the boat, who looks up, surprised. He didn't know that Zeed meant to leave him, I guess. We can look after ourselves all right. Mostly, I just want Queenie and Briny to come home and get us on down the river. I want that so bad. I hurt for it deep underneath the knot in my belly. We ain't got nothing to feed him. Camellia's in the door now, offering up her 2 cents. Well, good morning to you, Miss Rosie Ray of Sunshine. Zeed calls Camellia that all the time, on account of she's the exact opposite of that very thing. I was gonna go gig us some frogs. She announces it like she's been made captain of the Arcadia. No, you ain't, I tell her. We're not supposed to leave the boat, none of us. Zeed points a finger at my sister. You kids stay put. He narrows an eye back toward the river. Don't know what spooked the folks out of Mud Island Camp. It's good y'all are over in this little backwater by yourselves anyhow. Just keep quiet. Don't be calling any attention or nothing. Something new weighs on my chest. Something heavy. Worry scratches a setting spot inside me and takes up nesting. I don't want Zeed to leave. Fern saddles over to hang on my leg. I pick her up and snuggle her wild curls under my chin. She's a comfort. Gabian comes out, and I pick him up too. And their weight pins my feet to the floor. Queenie's shawl binds tight around my shoulders and squeezes into my skin. Zeed puts me in charge again, and he brings the boy, Silas, onto the Arcadia. Unfolded, Silas is taller than I thought. He's skinny as a rail, but he'd be handsome if it weren't for the busted lip and the shiner. If he was hobo in trains like Zeed said, he's lucky the railroad bulls didn't do worse to him. He hikes himself up on the porch rail, like that's where he means to stay. You watch after them now, Zeed tells him. Silas nods, but it's clear enough he ain't happy about it. A cooper's hawk flies by, looking for prey. And he watches it pass, then keeps his face pointed toward Memphis. Zeed leaves food behind, a bag of cornmeal, a bundle of carrots, 10 eggs, and some saltfish. Silas watches as Zeed climbs into his boat and disappears. You hungry? I ask him. He turns my way, and it's then I remember I'm in my natty. I feel the sticky air touching my skin where the neck pulls low from the babies on my hips. Silas looks away, like he noticed. Reckon. His eyes are dark as midnight on water. They reflect everything he looks at. A heron bird fishing nearby. Branches drooping from a half-broke tree. The morning sky with its foam-white clouds. Me.
You cook?
The way he says it makes it sound like he's already decided I can't. I lift my chin, square up my shoulders. Queenie's shawl cuts in deeper. I don't think I like Silas much. Yeah, I can cook. Poof, Camellia spits. You hush up. I set down the little kids and push them toward her. And watch after them. Where's Lark? Still in bed. Look after her, too. Lark can slip off quick and quiet as a whisper. One time, she laid up in a little clearing by a creek and fell flat asleep, and it was a whole day and half the night before we found her. Scared Queenie clean out of her mind. Reckon I better make sure you don't burn the place down, Silas grumbles. I decide it right then. I don't like this boy at all. But when we go through the door, he looks my way, and his split lip turns upward on one side, and I think maybe he ain't so bad. We light a fire in the stove and cook the best we can. Between Silas and me, neither of us knows much. The stove is Queenie's territory, and I've never cared a thing about it. I'd rather be outside watching the river and its animals, and listening to Briny spin stories about knights and castles and Indians out west and far-off places. Briny's seen the whole world near as I can figure. Silas has seen a bit himself. While we cook and sit down to eat, he tells tales about riding the rails and thumbing his way across 5 states and scratching up food in hobo camps and living off the land like a wild Indian. Why ain't you got a mama? Camellia asks as she finishes the last of a hoe cake that's just a little bit burnt on the edges. Lark nods because she wants to know too, but she's too shy to ask. Silas waves a fancy silver fork that Briny dug up in the sand by the wreck of an old riverboat. Had a mama. Liked her all right. Till I was 9. Then I left and ain't seen her since. How come? I look hard at Silas to see if he's teasing. As much as I miss Queenie already, I can't imagine being away from your mama on purpose. She married a fellow that liked drinking whiskey and handing out whippings. I took me a year of that, and I figured I was better off making my own way. The sparkle leaves his eyes for a minute, and there's nothing left but dark. But quick as it's there, he shrugs and smiles, and the little dents come back in his cheeks. I struck off with the harvest crew that was moving through. Went clear up to Canada picking apples and combining wheat. After that was over, worked my way back south again. When you was just 10... Camellia smacks her lips to let him know she's not believing a word of it. You done all that? I just bet. Smooth as a cat, he turns in his chair, lifts up the tail of his faded-out shirt, and shows us the scars across his back. All 5 of us jerk away from the table. Even Camellia hasn't got a smart mouth answer now. Be glad if you got a nice mama and daddy. Silas looks hard at her. Don't ever get it in your head to leave them behind if they're good to you. Some sure enough ain't. We all go quiet for a minute, and tears build in Lark's eyes. Silas sops up the last of his egg and drinks a swig of water. He looks at us over the rim of the tin cup, and frowns like he can't figure out what we're so long-faced about. Say, little bit, he reaches out and tweaks Lark's nose. And her lashes flutter like butterfly wings. Did I ever tell you about the night I met Banjo Bill and his dancing dog, Henry? Just like that, he's off on another story, and then another. Time goes by in a wink while we finish the last of the food and then clean up the mess. Your cooking ain't half bad. Silas licks his lips after we're done washing dishes in the pail on the porch. By then, Fern's got her dress on wrong side out. Because she's changed herself out of her nightie. And Gabian's running around half-naked, looking for somebody to clean him up after he sneaked to the outhouse off the back of the shanty all by himself. It's a good thing he didn't fall right through into the river. There's no bottom on a shantyboat outhouse, just the water. I tell Camellia to take him on the porch and dunk his rear in the river and then dry him off. It'll be easiest. Camellia's nostrils flare. The only thing that scares her in the whole wide world is poop. Which is exactly the reason I'm making her go clean Gabby. She deserves it. She hasn't helped with a thing all morning.
Milia, Milia!
Our baby brother cheers as his fat little legs wobble him toward the door, bare-bottomed.
I'm Etsy.
My sister sneers at me, then whips open the screen and drags Gabian out, pulling him up by one arm so that he stands on his tippy-toes.
I'll do it,
Lark whispers, hoping to end the fight.
You let Camellia see after it. You're not big enough.
Silas and I look at each other, and he smiles a little. Ain't you ever gonna get dressed? I look down and realize I never did change, and never even thought about it. I was so caught up in Silas's stories.
Guess I better,
I say, and laugh at myself, and get my dress down from the hook, then stand there holding it.
You gotta go outside, though, and no peeking.
There's been a funny little thought in my head while Silas and me been cooking and taking care of the babies. I've been play pretending like I was the mama, and Silas was the daddy, and this was our house. It's helped me not think about Queenie and Briny still being gone. But there's no way I'd get undressed in front of him, or anybody. I've come up big enough this past year that I dress behind the curtain in the shanty like Queenie does. I wouldn't stand still for somebody seeing me in the all-together any more than I'd let somebody whip me across my back and leave scars. Hick, Silas says and rolls his eyes. Why'd I be looking? You ain't nothing but a kid. My skin goes hot from head to toe and my cheeks boil. Outside the screen door, Camellia laughs. I blush harder. If I could, I'd knock her and Silas both off into the water right now.
And take the little kids out with you, I snap. A woman needs privacy.
How would you know anything about that? You ain't no woman. You ain't nothing but a little curly-headed Cupid doll, Silas teases. But I don't think it's funny, especially when Camellia can hear. On the porch, she's lined up with Fern and Lark, enjoying the show. Every muscle in my body goes stiff. I don't get mad easy, but when I do, it's like a fire inside me.
Well, you ain't nothing but a stick boy. The wind don't even have to slow down to blow around you. That's how skinny you are.
I square up on him, hateful as I can, and poke my fists into my hips.
Least I don't got hair that do to mop a floor with.
He grabs his hat off the hook and stomps out the door. From someplace near the gangplank, he yells,
You ought to join the circus. That's what you ought to do. You could be a clown.
I get a look at myself in the mirror on the wall, and there's blonde curls flying everywhere, and my face is red as a woodpecker's head. Before I can even catch hold of how I look, I'm running to the door to holler out,
Well, you can just keep walking, Silas, whatever your last name is, if you got one. We don't need you anyhow, and...
On shore, he drops down to a squat all of a sudden and bats a hand at me. I can't make out his face under the hat, but it's clear enough there's trouble. He's seen something in the woods. The heat in my skin changes direction and sucks inward.
Yeah, you can just keep walking, Camellia shouts,
jumping into the wrangle.
Get off our boat, stick boy!
Silas glances over, shoves his palm at us again. The brush closes around him as he scoots in.
You ain't hiding. I see you there. Hush, Camellia.
I whip open the screen door and yank Fern and Lark inside. Camellia gives me a crosswise frown. She's bent over the rail, dangling Gabian by his arms. His bottom swirls in the water while he kicks and giggles. Camellia pretends to drop him, then catches his arms again, and he lets out a squeal before I can get to them.
Come on inside.
Leaning out, I reach for my brother's arm, but Camellia swats me away and lets Gabby dangle by one hand.
He's having fun, and it's hot inside.
Her thick, dark hair falls forward, the tips reaching to the water, touching it like a spill of ink.
You want to go swimming?
She asks Gabby. For a minute, I think she's going to climb into the water with him. On shore, Silas pokes out of the brush and puts a finger to his lips, trying to throw quiet our way.
Something's wrong.
I catch Gabian's hand and swing him up like a wishbone, bringing my sister with him.
Ow!
She's mad when her elbow hits the rail.
Get inside.
Down shore, the leaves shiver apart, and I see black. A man's hat, maybe?
Somebody's out there.
Camellia snorts.
You just want that boy to come back.
She can't see Silas, but he's probably not 10 feet from where a branch snaps and a raven takes off, calling out complaints.
There, see?
Camellia catches sight of the black. It's somebody coming for sure. But instead of going in the door, Camellia slips around toward the other side of the boat.
I'll sneak off the back and check who it is. No!
I hiss. But the truth is, I'm not sure what to do. I want to toss off the lines and push the Arcadia out of the sand and take to the river. The water's still and calm this morning, so it'd be easy for us to put her out. Except I wouldn't dare try it. With nobody but Camellia and me and maybe Silas to keep the Arcadia from hitting a bar or getting plowed through by a barge or a paddle wheeler, there's no telling what could happen to us on the river.
Let's get inside, I say. Maybe he'll think the boat's empty and move on about his business.
But who'd have business down this little backwater where there's nothing around?
Maybe it's just somebody out squirreling,
Camellia says hopefully. Maybe he'd give us one for dinner if we're nice. She knows how to be sweet when she wants to, when somebody's got sugar candy to hand out or fry cakes to share around a campfire.
Zed told us to keep quiet, and Briny'd tan us good if he found out.
Briny's never tanned any one of us, but he threatens it sometimes. The idea worries Camellia enough that she hurries across the porch with me and we go inside. We bar the doors and climb up in the big bed and pull the curtain and wait and listen. I think I can hear the man walking on shore. Then I think he must have left. Maybe he was just a hunter or a hobo.
Hello, the boat.
Shh, my voice trembles. Wide, worried eyes turn my way. You grow up on the river, you know to be mindful of strangers. The river's a place men take to sometimes when they're running from the bad things they done someplace else. Camellia leans close.
That ain't Zed.
Her whisper ruffles the fine hairs on my neck. The hull rocks a little. Someone's trying the plank. Lark scoots close, and Fern crawls into my lap, her cheek pushing against my heart. The Arcadia sways toward shore, tipped by the man's full weight. He's big. Whoever he is, Silas isn't any match for him. I push a finger to my lips. The five of us freeze the way fawns do when the doe leaves them behind so she can go feed. The man is on the porch now.
Hello, the boat,
he says again.
Go away. There's nobody here.
He tries the door, the handle turning slowly.
Load in the boat.
The door hits the bar and can't go farther. A shadow hovers in the square of window light on the shanty floor. A man's head, the outline of a hat. There's a stick or a bat in his hand. He taps it against the glass.
A policeman?
I'm afraid it is. The police come after shanty boat folk when they feel like it. They raid the camps, rough up the river rats, take what they want, send us on our way. That's one reason we always tie up by ourselves, unless Briny's got some particular need for other people.
Help you, officer.
Silas's voice stops the stranger as he crosses to the other window to look in. Their shadows stretch along the floor together, one a head longer than the other.
You live here, son?
Nope, I was just out hunting. My daddy's over yonder a ways.
Some children live here?
The voice isn't hateful, but it means business. What if Silas gets himself arrested for lying?
Don't reckon I know. I just now seen the place. That's so, is it? Think you might be handing me a fib there, little river rat. I heard you talking to somebody on this boat.
No, sir, Silas sounds sure as sunrise. I seen these people go off in a skiff, couple hours ago, maybe. Must have been somebody down in the river camp used here and just now. Sound goes a long ways on the river.
The man takes a quick step toward Silas. Don't tell me about the river, sonny boy. This is my river, and I've been hunting these kids half the morning on it. You get them to come out, so I can take them into town to their mama and daddy.
When Silas doesn't answer, the officer bends close, their shadows connecting at the face.
Sonny boy, I'd sure hate to see you land yourself in trouble with the law. How'd you get that shiner on your eye, anyhow? You been into something you shouldn't be? You got folks looking after you, or are you astray?
My Uncle Zed, he looks after me.
I thought you said you came out here hunting with your daddy.
Him too.
You lie to a policeman, you'll find yourself in jail, River Rat.
I ain't lying. I hear other voices nearby now. Men yelling in the woods and a dog barking.
Tell the kids to come on out. Their mama and daddy sent us after them.
What's their daddy's name, then? Camellia and me look at each other. Her eyes are big as walnuts. She shakes her head. She's thinking the same thing I am. Briny wouldn't send the police here. And if he did send them, they would have known right where to find the boat. What does this man want with us?
We stare out the gap in the curtain as the big shadow lifts the little one up by the shirt collar. Silas coughs and gags.
Don't you sass mouth me, boy. I didn't come for you, but you give me any more trouble, we'll just take you with us. You'll see where scrawny little gutter snaps like you wind up in this city.
I'm out of the bed before Camellia can latch on and try to stop me.
No, Will, no!
She grabs at my nightie, but it slips through her fingers. When I open the door, the first thing I see is Silas's feet dangling 6 inches off the deck. His face is purple. He tries a punch, and the officer just laughs.
You want it, me boy. How about we put you under that water a minute or two and cool you off?
Stop! Don't!
I can hear other men coming. There's some on shore, and off the starboard, there's a motorboat rumbling up. I don't know what we've done wrong, other than being river gypsies, but we're caught for sure. It won't help for Silas to get himself killed or hauled off with us. The officer drops Silas all at once so that he lands against the shanty wall, hitting his head hard.
Go on, Silas,
I say, but my voice shakes so bad the words are barely anything.
You go home now. You ain't even supposed to be here. We want to go see Mama and Daddy.
I figure it'll go better if we cooperate. By myself, I might be able to jump off the porch and get away to the woods before the men could catch me. But with my little sisters and Gabian, there's no way it'd work. One thing I know about Briny is he'd want us to stick together, no matter what. I straighten my back, look at the police officer, and try to be as grown up as I can. He smiles.
That's a good girl now.
Is my daddy okay?
Sure he is.
And my mama?
Real fine. She asked for you to come visit.
I don't even have to see in his eyes to know that's a lie. It ain't possible that Queenie's real fine right now. Wherever she is, she's heartbroken about the babies. I swallow hard and feel it go all the way down, sharp like a piece of ice chipped fresh off the block.
I'll get the other kids.
The officer steps up,
grabs my arm like he means to stop me.
Ain't you a pretty little river rat?
His tongue slides across his teeth, and for the first time, he's close enough that I can see his face under the shiny hat brim. His eyes are gray, and they're mean. But they're not cold like I thought they'd be. They're interested, except I don't know why. His look moves from my face, down my neck, toward the shoulder that's hanging out of the nightgown right now.
Somebody ought to feed you up a little.
Behind him, Silas wobbles to his feet, blinks and staggers. He settles a hand on the axe that's standing by the woodpile.
No,
I try to say without saying it. Doesn't he hear the men downshore and the motorboat coming closer? From inside the shanty, there's a soft, high squeak just loud enough that I catch it. The outhouse door. Camellia's trying to sneak away through the back.
Do something.
My little brother just got off the pot. I need to clean him up before we go, or there'll be poop everywhere. Unless you want to do it. It's the only thing I can think of. Men don't like messy babies. Briny won't touch one at all except to dunk him in the river if Queenie or Camellia or me ain't there to do it. The officer curls his lip, lets me go, and turns to listen over his shoulder. Silas jerks his hand away from the axe, stands with fists gripped at the ends of his skinny arms.
Better hurry along.
The policeman's lips spread into a smile, but there's no kindness in it.
Your mama's waiting.
You go on now, Silas. Just get. I stop in the doorway, stare at him, thinking, go, run. The officer looks from me to Silas. He reaches toward his belt, toward the gun, the club, the black metal wristlets. What's he planning to do?
Go on, get,
I yell, and give Silas a shove.
Briny and Zed wouldn't want you here.
Our eyes lock. He shakes his head a little. I nod mine. He closes his lashes real slow, then opens them again, and turns and runs down the gangplank.
There's one in the water,
another policeman yells from the riverbank. The men in the motorboat holler, and the kicker throttles up.
Camellia.
I spin around and rush inside, the officer's heavy footsteps coming after me. He shoves me and I land against the cook stove, and he thunders to the back, where the stern door is hanging open. Fern, Lark, and Gabian are clustered along the rail. The man throws them back inside, hard, and they land in a pile, screaming and crying.
Amelia! Amelia!
Gabian wails, and points toward the outhouse, where our sister has shinnied down the privy hole into the river. She's slogging her way toward shore now, her wet nightgown clinging to her long, sun-browned legs. A police officer runs after her, and the men in the motorboat follow along in the water. She climbs a drift pile, as quick and nimble as a doe. Gabian lets out a high-pitched scream. The policeman on the back porch yanks his pistol from its holster.
No!
I try to lunge forward, but Fern's got my legs. We land on the floor, toppling Lark with us. She lets out a sharp cry, and the last thing I see before the wood box blocks my view is the man on shore, leaping over a branch, stretching out a hand, and catching Camellia by her long dark hair. When I come up again, she's fighting like crazy, kicking and screaming and growling. Her arms and legs flail as the policeman holds her away from his body. The guys in the motorboat throw their heads back and laugh like drunks at a pool hall fight. It takes three of them to get my sister in the boat, and two to hold her down once she's there. When they pull up to the Arcadia, they've got Camellia pinned on the floor. They're muddy and mad because she smells like the bottom of an outhouse, and she's gotten it on everybody. The officer on the Arcadia stands himself in the doorway, crossing his arms and leaning like he's comfortable there.
You get your clothes changed real nice now. Out here where I can see. We're not gonna have anybody else running off.
I'm not about to get dressed in front of him, so I take care of Gaby and Lark and Fern first. Finally, I just put my dress on over my nightie, even though it's way too hot for that. The policeman laughs.
All right, if that's the way you want it. Now you come on real sweet and quiet, and we'll take you to see your mama and daddy.
I do what he says, and follow him from the shanty, pulling the door closed behind us. I can't swallow, or breathe, or think.
Good thing the other four weren't so tough, one of the policemen says.
He has Camellia stuffed to the floor of the motorboat with her arms pinned up behind her.
This one's a wildcat. Smells more like a wild hog, the other officer in the boat jokes.
He helps us settle in, lifting Gaby in and then Fern and then Lark in, and telling them to sit on the floor. Camellia gives me a wicked look when I do the same. She thinks this is my fault, that I should have fought back and stopped it somehow. Maybe I should have.
She'll like these all right,
one of the men hollers as the motor kicks up and pushes us away from the Arcadia. He puts his big hand on Lark's head, and she ducks away, crawling up against me. Fern does the same. Only Gabian doesn't know enough to be scared.
She likes the blondes, don't she?
The officer who came on the Arcadia laughs.
Not sure what she'll do with little Stinky there.
He wags his chin at Camellia, and she hawks up a wad of spit and sends it at him. He lifts a hand like he'll swat her, but then he just laughs and wipes the mess on his trousers.
To the Dawson warehouse lot again,
the man running the motorboat asks.
Last I heard.
I don't know how long we're on the water. We travel across the river, then toward the channel where the Wolf pours into the Mississippi. When we round the tip of Mud Island, Memphis comes into full view. The big buildings stretch toward the sky like monsters waiting to swallow us whole. I think about jumping out into the water. I think about making a run for it. I think about fighting. I watch boats pass by, tugs and paddle wheelers and fishing boats and barges, even a shanty boat. I think about yelling and waving my arms and calling for help. But who would help us? These men are the police. Are they taking us to jail? A hand settles on my shoulder, like someone's been reading my thoughts. It stays there until we finally dock. Up the hill, I can see more buildings.
You be real good now, and keep your brother and sisters out of trouble,
the officer from the Arcadia whispers against my ear. Then he tells the other men to hold the wildcat back a minute, till she's seen the four of us. We march up the boardwalk in a line, me carrying Gabian on my hip. The clang-clang swish of machines and the smell of hot tar catch me, and I lose the sense of the river. We cross a street, and I hear a woman singing, a man yelling, a hammer striking metal. The loose fluff from cotton bales floats in the air like snow. In a scrappy bush at the edge of a parking lot, a cardinal sings his sharp song. Weep, weep, weep. There's a car nearby. A big car. A man in a uniform gets out and walks around to the back door and opens it so a woman can heave her way out of the seat. She stands looking at us, squinting against the sun. She's not a young woman, or an old woman, but someplace in between. She's thick and heavy, her body settling in rolls inside her flowered dress. Her hair is short. Some of it's gray, and some of it's brown. Her face makes me think of a heron bird. That's the way she watches while the policemen line us up. Her gray eyes move quick and jerky, tracking everything that's going on.
There should be five, she says.
The other's coming, Miss Tan, one officer says. She was a shade more trouble. Tried to get away in the river.
Her tongue clicks against her teeth. Tisk, tisk, tisk.
You wouldn't do that, would you?
She fingers Fern's chin and leans down until they're almost nose to nose.
You wouldn't be a bad girl, would you?
Fern's blue eyes go wide, and she shakes her head.
What a lovely little bunch of foundlings, the woman, Miss Tan, says. 5 precious blondes with curls. How perfect.
She claps her hands and folds them under her chin. Her eyes crinkle at the corners, and her mouth presses tight, so that she's smiling, but her lips are gone.
Only 4,
the officer nods toward Camellia, who's coming up from the river with a policeman holding her by the scruff of the neck. I don't know what they've told her, but she's not fighting anymore. Miss Tan frowns.
Well, that one didn't get the looks in the family, did she?
She's rather common.
I suppose we'll find a taker for her, though. We almost always do.
She pulls back, putting a hand over her nose.
Good heavens, what is that smell?
Miss Tan isn't happy when she sees up close what a mess my sister is. She tells the officers to put Camellia on the floorboard of the car, and the rest of us on the seat. There are 2 other kids on the floorboard already. A blonde-headed girl about Lark's age, and a boy who's a little bigger than Gabian. Both of them look at me with big, scared brown eyes. They don't say a word, or move an inch. Miss Tan tries to take Gabian out of my arms before I climb in. She frowns when I hold on.
Behave yourself, she says,
and I let go. Once we're all in the car, she holds Gabian in her lap, standing him up so he can see out the windows. He bounces and points and babbles, excited. He's never been in a car before.
My, my, look at those curls.
She slides her fingers along my baby brother's head, pulling his corn silk hair upward, so it has peaks on the top like the baby dolls at the county fair. Gabian points out the window, cheering.
Oh, see, oh, see!
He spotted a little girl having her picture made on a black and white pinto pony in front of a big house.
We just need to wash the stench of the river from you, don't we? Then you'll be a fine little boy.
Miss Tan's nose crinkles up. I wonder what she means by that. Who's going to clean us up? And why?
Maybe the hospital won't let us in this way, I tell myself. Maybe we have to wash up first. To see Queenie?
His name's Gabian, I say, so she'll know what to call him. Gabby for short. Her head turns quick, the way a cat's does when it's seen a mouse in the pantry. She looks at me like she forgot I was in the car.
Restrain yourself from answering questions unless you're asked.
Her arm snakes out, fleshy and pale, and surrounds Lark, pulling her away. I look down at the 2 scared kids huddled together on the floor, and then at Camellia. My sister's eyes tell me that she's figured out what I already know, even though I don't want to. We're not headed to the hospital to see our mama and daddy.
Chapter 7 Avery. The retirement home lies bathed in soft morning sunlight. Even with the newly added parking lot on what was once a sprawling front lawn, Magnolia Manor speaks of a bygone era, of the elegance of afternoon teas and glittering cotillions and formal dinners at the long mahogany table that still stands in the dining room. It's easy to picture Scarlett O'Hara fanning herself beneath the moss-draped live oaks that shade the white-columned veranda. I remember this place's former life, if only a tad. My mother brought me to a baby shower here when I was 9 or 10. Driving over, she shared the story of attending an important cocktail reception here for a cousin who was running for the South Carolina governorship. A college girl at the time, my mother had anything but politics on her mind. She wasn't at Magnolia Manor for 30 minutes before she noticed my father across the room. She made it her business to find out who he was.
When she learned that he was a Stafford, she set her cap. The rest is history. A marriage of political dynasties. My mother's grandfather had been a North Carolina representative before his retirement, and her father was in office at the time of the wedding. The story makes me smile as I climb the manor's marble steps and punch the code into the incongruously modern keypad beside the front door. Important people live here still. Not just anyone is allowed to enter. Sadly, not just anyone is allowed to exit either. Behind the manor, the expansive grounds have been carefully fenced in decorative iron too tall to climb over. The gates are locked. The lake and reflecting pool can be looked at but not reached, or fallen into. Many of the residents must be protected from themselves. That's the sad truth of it. As they decline, they move from one wing to the next, slowly progressing to higher levels of delicately provided care. There's no denying that Magnolia Manor is more upscale than the nursing home May Crandall lives in, but both places face the same underlying challenge: how to provide dignity, care, and comfort as life turns difficult corners. I wind my way to the memory care unit. Here, no one would even think of crassly calling it the Alzheimer's unit. I let myself through another locked door and into a salon where the television plays a rerun of Gunsmoke turned up loud. A woman by the window stares at me blankly as I pass. Beyond the glass, the climbing roses are dewy and fresh, pink and filled with life. The roses outside Grandma Judy's window are a cheery yellow. She's sitting in the wingback chair admiring them when I walk in. I stop one step inside the door and steel myself before drawing her attention from the plants. I prepare for her to look at me the same way the woman in the lounge did just now, without a hint of recognition. I hope she won't. There's never any telling. Hi, Grandma Judy. The words are bright and loud and cheerful. Even so, they take a minute to garner a reaction. She turns slowly, leafs through the scattered pages in her mind, then in her usual sweet way says, "Hello, darling. How are you this afternoon?" It's morning, of course. As I'd predicted, the DAR meeting ran late last night, and try as I might, I couldn't get away from the wedding interrogation. I was like a hapless grasshopper dropped into a henhouse. My head is now full of suggestions, dates I shouldn't plan on because someone important will be out of town, and offers to loan china, silver, crystal, and linens. "Wonderful, thank you," I tell Grandma Judy, and cross the room to hug her, hoping the moment of closeness will draw a memory from her. For an instant, it seems to. She looks deep into my eyes, then finally sighs and says, "You are so very pretty. What lovely hair you have." Touching it, she smiles. Sadness expands in my chest. I came here hoping for answers about May Crandall and the old photograph on her nightstand. That doesn't look very likely now.
"There was a little girl who had a little curl right in the middle of her forehead."
My grandmother smiles up at me. Cool fingers with paper-thin skin stroke my cheek. "And when she was good, she was very, very good," I add. Grandma Judy always greeted me with this poem when I visited her house on Lenape Street as a child.
"And when she was bad, she was horrid,"
she finishes, and grins and winks, and we laugh together. It's just like old times. I sit in the chair across the little round table. "I always loved it when you teased me with that rhyme." In Honeybee's home, little girls were expected to be anything but horrid,
but Grandma Judy had always been known for having a spunky streak that bordered on impropriety. She'd spoken out on issues like civil rights and education for women long before it was acceptable for a female to have an opinion. She asks if I've seen Welly Boy, her pet name for my father, Wells. I fill her in on yesterday's press op and the town hall forum, then the long, long, long DAR meeting at Drayden Hill. I skip over the wedding chatter, of course. Grandma Judy nods with approval as I talk, narrowing an eye and offering shrewd comments about the town hall meeting.
Wells mustn't let those people run riot over him. They'd love to catch a Stafford meddling in the dirt, but they won't.
Of course not. He handled it beautifully, just like he always does. I don't mention how tired he looked, or his seeming mental lapse under questioning.
That's my boy. He's a very good boy. I don't know how he could have given rise to a girl who can be horrid.
Grandma! I slap a hand over hers and squeeze. She's actually cracking jokes and drawing connections between us. It is a good day. I think it skipped a generation. I'm expecting a quick-witted retort. Instead, she says blandly, "Oh, many things do." She sinks back in her chair, her hand pulling away from mine. I sense the moment fading. Grandma Judy, I wanted to ask you something.
Oh?
I met a woman yesterday. She said she knew you. May Crandall. Does that sound familiar? The names of old friends and acquaintances she can often recall with ease. It's as if her memory book has fallen open, a persistent wind tearing out the most recent pages first. The older the memories are, the more likely they are to remain intact.
May Crandall.
As she repeats the name, I can tell immediately that she recognizes it. I'm already reaching for my phone to show her the photo when she says,
"No, it doesn't ring any bells."
I glance up from my purse, and she's looking at me very directly, thin white lashes narrowed over seawater eyes that suddenly seem strangely intense. I'm afraid we're about to have one of those moments where she stops in the middle of a conversation and without warning starts to visit over with something like, "I didn't know you were coming by today. How have you been?" Instead, she says,
"Is there a reason you would ask?"
"I met her yesterday, at the nursing home."
"Yes, you said. But many people know of the Staffords, dear. We must always be careful. People look for scandal."
"Scandal?" The word jolts me.
"Of course."
The phone suddenly feels cold between my fingers. I didn't know we had any skeletons in the closet.
"Gracious, of course we do not."
I scroll to the photo, look into the face of the young woman who reminds me even more of my grandmother now that I'm right across the table from her. She had this picture. Do you know the person in it? Maybe these are woodpile relatives? People my grandmother doesn't want to acknowledge as part of the family tree? Every clan must have a few of those. Perhaps there was a cousin who ran off with the wrong sort of man and got pregnant? I turn the screen toward her, watch for her reaction.
"Queen,"
she murmurs, reaching out to pull the phone closer.
"Oh."
Moisture wells up in her eyes. It beads and spills over, sketching trails down her cheeks. "Grandma Judy?" She's a million miles away. Not miles. Years. Years away. She's remembering something. She knows who that is in the photo. Queen.
What does that mean? Grandma Judy?
Queen.